bar stands.
Don't you just say.
Okay, good. That's what.
I don't remember your.
The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. We have in front of us Senate File 1822, which is Senator Clark's file. Senator Clark.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. I know you've had a long day already, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill. We believe that it's both important and hopefully pretty non-controversial at this point. We've been working with folks to make sure that's the case. This is essentially what we're referring to as a domestic violence lease bill. It's a bill about safety for the victims, for their children, and for other tenants. You may be aware that under current law, the victim of domestic abuse is essentially left with two pretty bad choices, either staying in an unsafe environment or fleeing and then either having to pay double the rent or getting evicted and incurring the kinds of costs that go with that, and frankly maybe having a hard time finding another place to rent. This bill permits a victim of domestic violence to terminate lease early if the tenant provides written notice to the landlord stating that they have an imminent fear of domestic abuse, that they need to leave, and that the date that the tenant will terminate the tenancy. The tenant must provide the notice and a copy of an order for protection or no contact order to the landlord prior to the date the tenancy terminates. And I'm going to go ahead and stop here for right now because I think it might make some sense for us. Do we have a delete all amendments? If we could put that on, and then if I could have Ms. Hugdahl go through and explain exactly what we're trying to do here. Mr. Horner does not need to talk, but we have him here in case you have questions. We do have one testifier that has experienced this herself, if you have time.
I move the amendment, Madam Chair.
And Senator Clark, this is the first time this bill has been before a committee, and I believe we are the only committee, correct?
That is correct.
So
we want to make sure you take the time with it, and we can go through it.
Sure.
But we've been working, like I said, we've been working this out, so I want to make sure we have it in the right form.
Senator Scheid moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Now on Senate File 1822 as amended, Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll just walk through the subdivisions of the bill to give kind of an idea of what the bill does. Subdivision 1 really sets out the process of what has to be in the notice that the tenant gives to the landlord. It has to be a person in a residential lease. This does not apply to people in privately owned homes with mortgages and things like that. This is in the landlord-tenant chapter. It's a person who's a victim of domestic abuse and fears imminent domestic abuse against themselves or their minor children if they remain in the premises. They must provide a notice to the landlord stating that they have an imminent fear of abuse from a person who's named in the order that's attached, that they need to terminate the tenancy, and the specific date that they're going to terminate that tenancy so the landlord knows the date that that's going to happen. The notice has to be given before they terminate, so you can't leave and then retroactively say, oh, now I want to claim the privileges of this section. You have to do it in a specific order of events. It tells how the notice is to be given, and it is clear that we're talking about orders for protection and no contact orders. In criminal cases, it does not cover harassment restraining orders. Subdivision 2 talks about how the information that the person gives to the landlord is treated. This is very similar to federal provisions that deal with tenants in Section 8 housing. Section 8 housing has these types of provisions already, so we're just mirroring that for Section 8 and those without Section 8, essentially saying that the landlord can't enter that paperwork, that evidence, into a shared database, that if they have to bring an action, if there's a dispute whether the person, the tenant, met the requirements of the law, they can certainly use that in the court proceeding. But just to be clear, that they can't put it on shared databases. Subdivision 3 talks about the tenant's liability and the termination of the tenancy. Essentially, if a tenant claims a right to break the lease under this section, they have to pay the full month's rent for the rent the month that they're terminating in, plus an additional amount equal to a month's rent. And that additional month's rent has to be paid on or before the date that they terminate the tenancy. And the landlord is entitled to keep that additional amount even if they re-rent the premises within the same month or on the first of the next month. That was a balance that we worked out with the Multi-Housing Association to kind of balance the fact that there may be some times where the landlord has a period of time where there may be no one in the apartment, and there may be times where they do have another tenant right away. So this was a piece that we worked out to try and balance that out. A claim under this statute does not affect if a person owes back rent. Other claims like that, the landlord still can pursue those claims. This doesn't have any impact on that if they haven't paid the rent before then. The right of possession terminates on that date that they give in their notice, and the amount equal to the 1 month's rent, again, must be paid on or before the date they terminate. Letter D really is talking about the security deposit. We wanted to be clear and have some clarity about when the things about the accounting for the security deposit would happen, both if the victim was the only tenant and if there were other tenants in the dwelling that were not involved, were not the ones moving out, if there would be other tenants left. So that section clarifies the law for that, so everyone knows when that what will happen with the security deposit. Subdivision 4 talks about multiple tenants. The tenancy continues, and those other tenants remain liable under the lease just like they would if this wasn't exercised. They remain liable for the rent and the damages and anything else they would ordinarily be liable for, and that would include the person who is subject to the order for protection as well if they are on the lease. So if they happen to be co-tenants and one person moves out, the other person is still liable. Subdivision 5 clarifies, and this is a provision in a lot of provisions under the landlord-tenant chapter, that a landlord cannot ask a tenant to waive their rights, for example, in an application, that they would just say, as applying, I also waive my right under this section of the law. So we put in a statement that that cannot be waived. And Subdivision 6 is simply a definition of domestic abuse as a cross-reference back to Chapter 518B.
Senator Clark and Ms. Hugdahl, in the in Subdivision 1, subparagraph A, when we talk about a tenant or resident to a residential lease who is the victim of domestic abuse, and then they submit this advance notice to the landlord stating that they have fears imminent domestic abuse from a person named in the order for protection or no contact order, is sort of the proof, right, of that is a order for protection or a no contact order?
Madam Chair, yes.
So Senator Lummer is my landlord. When I write him the notice, I would have to put one of those orders in it. I can't just say I am a victim of domestic abuse and expect him to believe that without that information.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. You must attach a copy of the order to the notice.
And Madam Chair, it also means that we're not putting the victim in the place of having to justify, as it were, state additional proof. They've already gotten the court order, but that means that obviously then the landlord will have the kind of information they really need.
Sure. Any questions for Senator Clark or Ms. Hugdahl? Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Clark, I noticed that the and maybe we've already covered this, but the term imminent domestic abuse, mm-hmm. is that a separate definition that would be a precursor to this action of a tenant leaving? Or do we go back to the example that Senator Moi had suggested, that it has to be more of a legal recognition that there is imminent danger?
Senator Clark, Ms. Hugdahl?
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, the imminent fear, if it's the elements in line 1.11 through 1.14, that's an additional piece. What we discussed with multi-housing associations, we didn't want people to, their concern was they didn't want people to say, I have an order, and even though there's no imminency to it now, because the order is good for a year and maybe two, that they would have the order and leave when there's really, we're really trying to get at those folks who need to leave the apartment for their own safety. And that was the genesis of the word imminent fear.
One other question that I did have. I understand that the termination of tenancy in a lease explains the balance of the rent payment due would be the balance of the month that the notice was given, that the tenant is responsible for that balance of the of that month and one more month, regardless of how the lease agreement was written up originally?
Ms. Hogdahl.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, yes, that's correct. What would happen, for example, if you served a notice in January and let's say the date that your tenancy is terminating is in January, even if it's the 10th of January, you owe the full month of January plus another additional amount equal to a month's rent that must be paid by the 10th of January.
Madam Chair, that also means that if there was one day left in the month of January, January 31st, then that tenant would only be responsible for 29 days left, provided it was not a leap year. And so 29 days is all that would be left. It's not 45 days or 60. It could be down as low as 29 days. And I was just wondering if the landlord or the representatives of landlords are in agreement with this proposal.
Mr. Horner.
Thank you. Jack Horner representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, we are in agreement with this. It seems as though a good compromise in working out the interests of the two parties, and so we believe that this produces a good result.
They're the ones that use January. And I just
only Senator Limmer and a leap year. Senator Shy.
Next year
is a leap year.
Next year.
This could be effective.
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Hogdahl may have said, or maybe it might have been Senator Clark, who referenced the fact that they couldn't leave until they gave this notice. But I think I don't see anything in here that says it. I think you possibly, very likely, could be in the situation of you've left. You're gone out of that apartment if you're really afraid. But you still then, I understand you'd owe the balance of that month, which you possibly paid, hopefully paid on the first anyway, and then the subsequent month. Am I correct? So you could physically be gone. Okay, I didn't see anything that said you couldn't, but I thought you said you couldn't.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, yes, under B, it simply says the written notice must be delivered before the termination of the tenancy. Mm-hmm. So, yes, indeed, a person could have fled, but then come back and taken care of that.
Yeah.
And that then would become the date.
Senator Neville.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to ask a question for the record. Subdivision 1 doesn't require the tenant to prove anything, right? I mean, the landlord couldn't contest that she's in imminent fear. For example, if you could prove that the person subject to the order for protection was in a different country now, had moved, they still can't contest it. It's just a notice. Is that correct?
Ms. Hogdahl?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think realistically, if the landlord has a reason to believe that this section's not properly exercised, they would have the right to go before the court and bring an action for essentially unpaid rent under the balance of the lease. It would then become a discussion with the court about whether the person had met that. What we've crafted is something where the victim is not coming to a landlord and having the discussion between landlord and tenant about whether that's there or not, or the landlord giving that okay. suggestion to the tenant of whether they think they should leave or not. So it doesn't really foreclose any options that the landlord's under the court, really.
Madam Chair, I was expecting you to say it's just a notice, but now you've just confused the record. because I mean, what you're now saying is that a landlord could theoretically challenge the notice. I didn't take that to be the intent. The intent is you just give a notice. If the tenant says, I'm in imminent fear of imminent domestic abuse, mm-hmm. she doesn't have to prove anything. She just has to say it.
Or he.
Correct.
Correct.
And again, is that right?
Ms. Hogdahl.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, that okay. is correct.
And then, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
Could you explain to me on page 2, line 13, that second sentence, what that means?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I assume you mean the sentence starting a person named
yes,
in the order?
Yes.
Essentially, what this means is if the person who the order is against is the respondent or the criminal defendant is also on the lease, as a tenant, they remain liable even if they've been excluded.
Okay.
That doesn't let that person off the hook from their liability under the lease.
Okay, Madam Chair, that makes sense. The way I read it, it wasn't clear that they had to be on the lease. It almost seems a little ambiguous, but is it possible to clarify that a little bit? It remains liable under the lease, but that doesn't mean they have to be a party to the lease. So what you really intend to say, I think, is if the person in the order for protection has been excluded from the premises under an order upon which, or let's see, on the premises of which he is a party to the lease, he remains liable under the lease. That's the intent. So,
Madam Chair, I would think on page 2, line 14, after the word who, you might say, who is a party to the lease but has been excluded from the premises.
Okay.
I think something like that might get you there.
That would do it. Mm-hmm. Could I just move that correction?
Senator Neville moves that correction. Senator Clark, are you all right with that?
Yes, I think it helps clarify it.
Any discussions on that correction? Seeing none, all those in favor of that correction say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
And then, Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Neville.
If the person subject to the order for protection is on the lease and the person leaves, can he move back in now? If he's got to pay the rent anyway, can he move back in?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think the answer to that would be they would have to probably go and modify the order that excluded them to really do that in the best way. I think they can, but they really need to do it through the order that excluded them in the first place to take care of that. I don't think there's anything short of, if they get the order modified, nothing in here would prohibit that.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering
Senator Neville, would
it be helpful to say that so that there's absolutely no doubt that if he's going to be paying the rent because the other party has left, that he can go back in and be entitled to get the order for protection changed, so at least he can get some benefit from paying that rent?
And Senator Neville and Ms. Huddall, I would think that from the landlord's perspective, if that tenant desires to come back and somehow change that order and then continue to live there, I would think that the landlords would like that unless they think that this is a good reason to terminate the lease. Ms. Ogdahl?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I'm going to actually defer to Mr. Horner on this because my sense is there may be some people who are the subject of the order, the landlord might not particularly want to come back into the apartment. So I defer to Mr. Horner on that because that
Mr.
Horner? Really...
Mr. Horner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Neville. I think that's correct. I think it would depend on the individual circumstances, how long the other person has been out, if it's been a day or if it's been a month or several months. I think there's a lot of circumstances that are probably just best left to what would normally operate anyway. Somebody would go and ask if it's now okay if he moves back in. The person who's been excluded has a right to a hearing and could so request that. But if the person's been gone for some time, it may be that there are other tenants or that the tenant has been, for other reasons, a troublesome person, and it may be that you won't wind up just moving in back in automatically.
Madam Chair, members, it strikes me that there would be a fairly common situation where you've got two people living together, domestic abuse happens, so maybe the guy's kicked out, but then the woman wants to cancel the lease, and the guy would want to move back in. It seems like that would be something happening frequently. And he's got a contract that would entitle him to come back to have possession. The order for protection is really intended for the protection of the victim. So how would you resolve that? Is the best way to resolve it just to leave it unsaid and let him go back into the order to the court, the domestic abuse court, and get the exclusion from the premises lifted, and then just let them move back in that way, or should we explicitly deal with it somehow?
Okay. On this point, Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and on this point, since they're not allowed to provide this information to anyone else, I'm wondering how that person is even going to know, if they're not around the apartment because they're not supposed to be there, that it's even vacant and available for their use again. And yet they might still continue to be responsible for the payment under this because it says that anyone else that's on the lease is still continues to be responsible. I don't know how you get around that.
Well, Madam Chair, they'll find out when they find out they got to pay. They probably don't care if they don't have to pay. But if the landlord's going to expect them to pay the rent yet, they're going to say, well, shoot, I might as well live there then, too. That's how I think they'd find out.
On that point, certainly the victim is not going to contact the abuser and say, by the way, I'm giving the notice and moving out, because you don't want to even let the abuser know that I'm leaving. And if the landlord is not allowed to communicate that information, how would they, at what point does the abuser know it's okay to move back in, because you're liable for it, and there's nothing in here that provides for that kind of a notice.
Practically speaking, Mr. Horner, how would that work in that circumstance if the landlord is not permitted to tell the perpetrator?
Madam Chair, I think, first of all, to answer a couple of questions, I think the landlord actually could tell the perpetrator or the person on the order for protection that the other person has now moved out. You can't disclose the information upon which the order was obtained, the affidavits regarding abuse and that kind of thing. But the fact of somebody now moving out, that fact alone could certainly be conveyed. But I think more importantly, Madam Chair, I don't think the landlord would want to get involved in that. These are often complex and kind of difficult situations to sort out. I think it's agreed between all of us in our lengthy discussions on this bill that sometimes people indicate an intention to move out and maybe don't. Sometimes, unfortunately, perhaps they invite the abuser back in. Maybe they attempt to reconcile. That appears to be a common thing. I'm no expert in this area, but what I am told, that appears to be the situation. I don't think it would be very wise or up to the landlord in most cases to start calling the other person and say, it's okay to move back in. I think it should go through the court. There should be a fact-finding. We should determine that the abuse victim really is out and doesn't intend to come back. I mean, there's a lot of things to be resolved that the landlord could very well be jumping in the middle of and to the detriment of everybody, it seems to be.
Senator Betzel.
Well, but the point, Mr. Horner, that Senator Neville is raising is the fact that on page 2, there's a requirement, there's a liability for the excluded tenant. Somebody was told to move out, and that person is now going to be liable for the rent and damages to the premises, even though the person's not living there. And that person is not going to know that the victim is no longer there, but somehow the landlord is going to say, but I want to get, I want to get my money, and I'm going to look to, the abuser, the excluded tenant, for it. How do they communicate that? Or should we just take that part out that says that the abuser is not responsible for the, is not liable for the rent? I mean, you got to have it one way or the other. I mean, if the landlord is expecting to hold the excluded tenant liable, then we should have something in here that says the landlord may notify the excluded tenant, that the apartment is available or the lease premises is available for the party. I don't know how you can reconcile these two unless you choose one of those. Which one? Do you want the liability or not?
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I think you've got a situation there, though, that the order that's being served on the individual is going to be delivered to him, and it's going to indicate that she or he can't return to the premises. I've never seen any OFP, for instance, didn't have some kind of order to get the party out of the house. And the other thing here is that if you were the perpetrator and were charged, that would be one thing on a monthly lease basis. But if you're looking at somebody that's got a year-long lease, it seems to me that that might be totally different. Maybe Mr. Horner can clear that up.
Mr. Horner, in a situation where it's a 12-month lease, only a month of it into the lease, one of the spouses vacates, the other one technically who is also is on the lease is really liable for the rest of the other 11 months. As a landlord, you say you're liable, and the person is—it's gone. I mean, the person is gone. You can choose to say they're gone, and you lease the space to someone else. They come back and say, "I have a lease, and I have a lease, and I want to live in it. And you've rented the space to someone else, or you don't want them back." You have to deal with them in some way. I mean, we're only talking about an opportunity here for the landlord to be able to repossess the property, but by imposing this liability, you are also tying the landlord's hands to continue to be obligated to this person for that the rest of that 12-month lease.
I think, Madam Chair, if the person who's been excluded, the person on the restraining order, comes back and says, "I want to take possession," the landlord would not be able to refuse him. As has been mentioned before, the person is on a lease, and the other tenant has moved out. This kind of thing happens sometimes, not just in domestic abuse situations, but in other situations where there are parties on the lease, but roommates, for example, who may have reached kind of a discord. If a person has a contract, the landlord cannot let them out, and the law is very clear in that you cannot unlawfully oust somebody. That means you cannot physically remove him or turn off, change the doors. If somebody comes and says, "I want to be here, I've got a right to be here," I think the landlord would have to let him in. Secondly, however, I don't think we want the landlord affirmatively contacting the other party and saying, "You have a right to move in now," because the landlord isn't the judge, and he should not be in the position of making those decisions. I think the person who's been excluded will certainly know what the situation is. I mean, after all, the victim is in imminent fear. That means the person is probably still around. He knows the situation. He may be unwelcomely visiting the premises. I think it's fairly safe to say that person will find out. And if he doesn't know, I'm not sure that the victim would want the landlord blabbing and saying, "Hey, you know, she's gone now. Yeah. Come on back." Maybe the victim doesn't want that person to know it. It seems to me that all these things being weighed, these facts are true. The person on a lease would have a right to move back in unless under some kind of a permanent order from the court. But even under just the ordinary contract law, the person would have a right to be there. The landlord would not have a right to exclude him. Secondly, it seems to me it is best left to the parties with the necessity of a judge modifying or rescinding an order if that part of it is necessary. And I think that on a case-by-case basis, it seems to me that the parties would find a way to protect their rights and to make it work.
Senator Olson.
Well, it just occurred to me that if we put something in here that eliminated the liability provision, that the other possible thing that we might create is an opportunity for this to be misused fraudulently. Let's just say two parties together want to get out of a lease, and if they're both excluded because one gets an order for that would be going to quite an extreme, but when there is money involved, I don't think we want to let them both just walk away from this either. I think that might not be fair to the landlord.
Senator Betzel.
I was trying to wonder what would happen if we simply did not have that sentence that starts on line 2.13, because the situation that you're going to have is the victim got a no-contact order and maybe which ordered the abuser to leave the leased premises. And then the victim decides that the victim's in imminent danger and wants to terminate the lease. And the victim is able to terminate the lease under this bill only as to the victim, not terminate it as to the abuser. One of two things will happen. If the abuser's been ordered to leave, maybe the abuser is going to move out and never come back. may still have a right to under the lease, but maybe the abuser may have to go to court and seek that, or maybe the landlord might be seeking the money. And maybe this is just one of those things that you have to go case-by-case basis and let the if the landlord wants to sue for the unpaid rent, or if the abuser wants to get back into the premises, maybe these are the things that you got to let the housing court decide, you know, whether the lease is still there or whether the rent ought to be paid. I don't know that we can really be deciding, if as long as, you know, if we just deleted that, where are we at?
Senator Clark?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I've got a couple different ideas. First off, I think that certainly what Senator Betzel has just raised is a very good point, that if you limited that sentence beginning on 2.13, it would seem that any current lease provisions would still be in effect. So if they were still liable, they would. So to me, that would actually be the cleanest way of dealing with it. But I know that Mr. Horner has strong reservations about not having this language in here. So if the language in here remains, then it would seem like we would want to go ahead and put in a sentence that relates to that should the apartment be vacated, that a notice from the landlord would be sent to the other party saying it's been vacated and you can move back in. The problem with that, unless we add something else, though, is that most likely the order of protection still trumps that. And so then they would still have to go back to court. So I don't know if there's something else we can do to address your concerns, Mr. Horner, because it does actually seem like it protects your landlord best if we eliminate that sentence, because the current lease would still be in effect.
Madam Chair, I think essentially that's true. The current lease would remain in effect. The purpose of much of the language of this section, however, is because this is unique. It's a departure from ordinary landlord-tenant law in some respects. It seemed to us to be important to clarify exactly what is intended and exactly what the rights of all the parties are in each case. For example, we spell out exactly how the damage deposit will work, because this is a bit of a unique situation. And it seems to me useful for purposes of clarity to state what I believe is the law, that the excluded person would indeed continue remaining liable under the lease.
Well, Mr. Horner, you know, it's they're your clients, but I think that an application, you're putting your landlords in a gray area here. I mean, if the guy still has chairs and tables and clothes and a stereo set and a television in there, but the guy's not coming back, but there's still a 12-month lease in play, what is your landlord going to do? I mean, under landlord-tenant law, doesn't your landlord have to store the possession, hold on to it? Doesn't your landlord now have to go and evict the person? I think that I know that you're trying to help your landlord here, but I think you're putting your landlord in a pretty tough place where we haven't given them the clear cut options. If I were a landlord and I were looking at this, I wouldn't know what to do. I don't want to store the guy's television set and clothing, and where do I find the guy to evict him? And what do I do? I mean, at that point, forget the three months rent that he owes me. I just want his stuff out of there so I can re-rent the place. But I think this is going to be contrary to what you actually want to do, which is to give your landlord some options. I'm not going to argue with you to take it out, but I just want to tell you that just from my perspective, that's what I see. Any other discussions?
Madam Chair, just really, really quick. It appears that under Section 8, which, as we talked about at the beginning, utilizes this right now, that they are actually silent on that provision. I don't have that site in front of us to look at, but that appears that it would be similar to what is being suggested here.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move to delete the second sentence. It starts on page 2, line 13, and runs through line 16. Now, it's entirely possible, you know, we've got time for this bill to get to the floor. You know, perhaps, you know, Senator Clark and Mr. Horner or others, you know, might be able to work up something that's a little bit more workable. I just don't think this one is. And I think that, frankly, the landlord is going to still be able to hold the excluded party liable for the lease. But I think that this language just confuses it. And, in fact, it might put the victim at risk, because if the landlord now goes and notifies the excluded party, by the way, there's a law that says that you're liable for the rent, that tips off the excluded party that, oh, by the way, the victim's moved. And now you know something you didn't know before. So I think by eliminating it, it probably gives greater protection to the victim, and it probably I think it lets have settled law on landlord tenant rights just work their way through. But I don't think this helps.
Any further discussions?
I'll move to delete that sentence.
Any further discussions, Senator Clark? We understand your position, Mr. Horner. We know that you probably don't want that eliminated.
Madam Chair, I don't. We can certainly continue working on it. If I could, though, just respond in one direction that you had mentioned, Madam Chair. It's true that if a tenant leaves, whether by abandonment or he's been evicted or for whatever reason, and leaves personal property behind, the landlord has indeed the duty to store it, to keep it in good condition. And there's provision in statute. You store it for 60 days, and you send a notice, the last known address, et cetera, and you follow the procedure, and then you can dispose of the property. So there is procedure in place, and that would be in effect in any case, no matter under any circumstances. Secondly, landlords are used to dealing with the concept of a tenant having abandoned. This would not... with this sentence in there, a landlord would still be able to make the judgment that a tenant has abandoned. It happens with regularity. And there's statute again. A tenant can make that decision. Can make that decision. And once it determines that it's reasonably apparent that the person's abandoned, then you can re-rent the apartment. You can. So whether or not this language is in there, the landlord would still have to make that decision whether or not he believes the person has abandoned. Now, if the person makes it clear he has or has not abandoned, that's a different story. But if he's just gone and never shows up again, the landlord has to make that decision. All this does is clarifies that he remains liable. And again, Madam Chair, there's ample precedent for this. Under a contract, tenants often remain liable for rent, their obligations, even though they don't live there. And I think it's not the landlord's fault or doing or any way that now he may be exposed to liability for no rent at all because of situation beyond his control. So he lets the abuse victim move out under this statute, but the other person, it seems to me, should remain liable. I mean, after all, he's the person who caused this kind of whole thing in the first place, and whether or not he lives there, he has the duty under the lease, and that's well established under law, both case law and our Supreme Court has spoken on that many times.
The order for protection made him leave. That's not abandonment. That's not abandonment, and that's, I think, the quandary that your landlord's going to be put under. But I, you know what? Any further discussions on Senator Betzel's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, this is just a very minor technical thing, and I wonder what Senator Higgins thinks about this, but on line 1.11.
Is it grammar and punctuation?
This is a committee joke.
It's the only thing I really know how to do, Senator Clark.
It says the tenant fears imminent domestic abuse from a person named in the order for protection, even though there's been no earlier reference to an order for protection.
An order.
So I'm thinking that should say an order instead of the order.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think that's an excellent modification. And it looks like Senator Higgins concurs.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Madam Chair, I hope that means Senator Limmer is going to explain what differentiation is when it comes to the floor.
you just committed yourself. That's grammatically wrong.
Foley's got more no votes tonight than I do.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1822, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? Anyone else in the audience would like to participate in this conversation? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Higgins.
Now we get into it. I just have a few questions. Can they pay us for this?
Senator Higgins, it's not a good thing when committee members start laughing when you get up there.
People laugh too, isn't it?
Either that or there is a lot of good stuff in that happy family order.
Madam Chair, I have two amendments that I need to have put on the bill to put it in the order we need to work on it. One is the A3 and one's the A4. This is not the first committee this has been through, so I can't do them as author's amendments. But
Senator Higgins, do you want to reference the language and the two amendments as we go through the bill?
Can we do that? Are the two amendments, you know, some amendments you
try to explain it doesn't make sense outside of the context of the bill, and some amendments will make sense. So you be the judge of that, whether or not you need to.
And they're page and lines, so we can probably work our way through that.
All right.
Okay.
Do all the members have all the amendments?
The A3 amendment is the civil section, and the A4 amendment amends the criminal section. So Ms. Pontius and Mr. Backus both have been very busy working on this bill for us today.
And just for purposes of the committee, Senator Higgins, tell us which sections of this bill are in the committee. Entire bill?
Probably all of it.
I was hoping you would say sections 2 and 4.
Well, okay, all that right. Works.
He deleted those.
Madam Chair. 2 and 4. We deleted through 2.
All right. Who would you like to present the bill?
Amber, do you want to? Okay. Ms. Hawkins will.
Ms. Hawkins, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hawkins, and I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. Madam Chair, I can, depending on how much detail the committee would like, I can talk about the basic things the bill does and then what the amendment actually does, the amendments do.
That would be fine.
All right. Madam Chair, this bill is an essential counterpart to the bill that was debated in the Senate yesterday, Senator Higgins' other predatory lending bill, Senate File 809. This bill has a couple of additional substantive protections for homeowners, for borrowers, rather, and it also contains the penalties, the civil private right of action for injured borrowers, and also criminal penalties for the most egregious offenses. The bill does 4 main things. It limits the imposition of prepayment penalties on mortgage loans to being imposed on prime mortgage loans only. In other words, it prohibits prepayment penalties on subprime mortgage loans. It requires a borrower to show that they've received mortgage counseling if the borrower is going to refinance what is referred to in the bill as a special mortgage. That's a very narrow group of mortgages. Basically, it would be a Habitat for Humanity loan or loans that where either interest or principal is deferred or completely forgiven. If the borrower wants to refinance one of those kinds of mortgages and roll it into a loan where they're going to be charged interest and payments, they would have to show that they've received counseling. The third thing the bill does is it provides a private right of action for borrowers who are injured by the substantive protections for homeowners in both the mortgage area and also the area of appraisals. And then finally, what the bill does is provides a criminal penalty for mortgage fraud offenses. These amendments do, Madam Chair, I'll start with amendment number A3 first. There has been quite a bit of discussion between the industry representatives and the author and others involved in the bill. And this first provision from lines 1.3 to line 1.23, that is the definition of subprime that was agreed upon by the parties. The next thing that A3 amendment does, if you look at lines 1.30 to 1.35, the first version of this bill required housing counseling and required that the counselor be certified by approved by HUD or the bill stated the commissioner. The bill also stated that the commissioner needed to post a list of approved housing counseling agencies. That part has been removed, and the amendment will clarify that the housing counseling can be provided by agencies who are certified by HUD or some other nonprofits who certify housing counselors. So it takes the Commissioner of Commerce out of this provision. On page 2, line 1, from lines 2.1 to 2.4 of the A3 amendment, what that does is it exempts what are called jumbo loans from the prepayment penalty ban. In other words, even though prepayment penalties will be banned in subprime loans, in the event that a jumbo loan would be considered subprime, the bill does not ban prepayment penalties in jumbo loans. And jumbo loans are indexed and updated each year, but right now it's running around $400,000 as a jumbo loan. The final thing that this A3 amendment does, on advice of Senate counsel, it fixes up the provision on punitive damages in the private right of action for violations of Chapter 58. The original bill provided that punitive damages shall be awarded for violations, and then listed a couple of factors that would be considered in the determination of punitive damages. And in the original bill, that would be lines 6.25 to 6.27. There's a state law, Minnesota Statutes 549.20, that discusses the factors for awarding punitive damages, what the court needs to consider, the process the litigants need to go through. And so to clear up any confusion about which criteria to apply, this amendment makes it so that the bill states simply and punitive damages, which would by default direct the litigants in the court to Section 549.20, which provides a detailed structure for punitive damages. The remainder of this amendment are some technical changes.
Let's take questions on this amendment and the bill up until now, because we're going to shift gear into another amendment, if that's all right, Senator Higgins.
Sure.
Members, questions to Senator Higgins or the witness on the A3 amendment and the bill, parts of the bill up until now. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I read the first bill and I had lots of questions. Now I'm trying to shift. Is it true that we have taken out the definition of that's found in the original bill on Section 1 and Section 2 by this amendment?
Ms. Pondius?
Definition of prime loan and investment grade.
Yep, Madam Chair, that's true. That would come out with the amendment.
Are we making any reference to prime loan or investment grade in the rest of the bill now.
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the definition of investment grade that had been placed in Subdivision 27 was actually pulled out of an existing piece of Chapter 58. And
we need a punitive one.
What the bill had originally done is pull that piece out and then define investment grade, prime, and subprime all in the same spot. With this new definition of subprime, this separate piece on investment grade is no longer necessary in that spot. So this has been removed. It is still in the same spot in 58 that it used to be, which is 58.13 subdivision 18. So it just restores that back.
No reference statute.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, if I could direct your attention to on the original bill, page 4. It's talking about inclusion of a prime loan that would be prohibited from being charged, receiving, or collecting any prepayment penalty. Now, this, when we put in prime loan, does that mean that other loans that are not prime loan then would be subject to these fees?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, when we put in prime loan, that means that the limitations that follow that section would be applied to prime loans with prepayment penalties.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I noticed on page 6, lines 15 through 17, we then make a separate entry that says a residential mortgage originator shall not enter into a subprime loan that contains a provision requiring or permitting the imposition of a penalty fee, premium, or other charge. Why do we have those two separate things written into three pages apart, and yet at the same time, if we would have just left the new language out of it, wouldn't that have covered the same thing? Why are we rewriting it for a subprime and prime loan almost in the same exact definition?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'll see if I understand and can answer that. But the history here is the bill began with a total ban on prepayment penalties for all loans. So what it had done was delete that entire section with the limitations on, you know, how much could be charged in a prepayment penalty. And then we went back and reinstated those penalty or those limitations, but only for prime loans, and then specified underneath that a prepayment penalty can't be charged at all for subprime loans.
And the point that I'm trying to make is on page 4, if you go back to 4, lines 34, if you didn't put in the new language that says that is a prime loan, if you read that paragraph, it basically says a residential originator making a residential mortgage loan, skip the new language, to a borrower located in this state, shall not charge, receive, or collect any prepayment penalty. Our existing law does not allow prepayment penalties, fees, premiums, or other charges. So why are we going through this of isolating these two things when the state law already says that we can't charge that in a prime or subprime at all? Isn't that the way I read that?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think Mr. Cox may be able to more adequately answer your question.
Okay.
Mr. Cox, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Prentice Cox, Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I was chair of the Predatory Lending Study Group, which Senator Higgins was a member of, that drafted much of the bill originally. Senator Limmer, I think the answer to your question is that that your predecessors who adopted this provision in 2002 wrote it so that you have to actually read all the way down to subpart B. It doesn't read very well. You have to read down to subpart B. It originally says you can't have a prepayment penalty, but then B says if you do have a prepayment penalty that exceeds these limits, then you offer these disclosures. So the way it reads now, you can't make these charges for any partial prepayment or for any prepayment that exceeds certain limits, is what it says. It doesn't say you can't make these prepayment charges at all. That's the existing law. So the existing law allows that to go on. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Well,
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, yes, I think it does, but it's why do we have paragraph B on page 514? Or is this because there's other loans out there that this particular provision of law does not cover?
Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the hidden bogeyman here that doesn't appear is federal preemption. So subpart A is puts limits section A puts limits on prepayment penalties under state law. Section B exists because at the time this was passed, the Alternative Mortgage Parity Act, the federal AMTA Act, preempted most state prepayment penalty prohibitions. And this was actually, at the time, a clever attempt to say, if you don't have to comply with A because of federal law, then you have to make all these oral and written disclosures to make sure that consumers understand they have a prepayment penalty. And now there are also, there continues to be existing federal preemptions under the National Bank Act and Federally Chartered Institution Act. So there still is a viability for having this section in there, although it was probably put in response to the AMTA preemption, which no longer exists for prepayment penalties.
Senator Limmer.
I also wanted the record to know that Mr. Cox had helped me in a particular mortgage matter a few years ago. I don't know if you remember that, but being in my trade, I had to find a balance on a particular loan balance that was originated in California. And I called your office because I couldn't find anyone in the state of Minnesota or anyone to answer the telephone in California to give the balance so that we could close a real estate transaction. It's just amazing how our paths keep crossing. But it's, and he did a great job.
I was waiting for that part, Senator.
He knew.
Thank you.
It's late, you know.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think we need to add one more thing to the A3 amendment. You'll notice that on page 6 and page 7, section 6 is the private right of action, and section 8 is a private right of action. And in the A3 amendment, we amended the punitive damages part on Section 8, but we also need to amend it on Section 6, and that would be line 6.25, delete everything after the first damages, add a semicolon and the word and then delete everything to the end of the sentence, which would be on 6.27.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, as long as we're on that exact point, Senator Higgins, I was talking to counsel about the fact that the way that, with your amendment, the way this now reads is that the court shall award punitive damages. And punitive damages are generally an optional thing that's awarded under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. And since it doesn't say may award, it says shall award. I think if you're making that change, counsel suggested that the line should end up reading shall award punitive damages if appropriate, comma, and as provided in sections 549.191 and 549.20. Those are the sections that relate to how we normally handle the award of punitive damages.
That would be great. When we should put it in both places then as well. Okay.
Well, Senator Olson, would you repeat that?
With respect to the amendment for both of those sections, the language would be after the omission of the word, or after
paren three per punitive damages.
Punitive damages, if appropriate, comma, and as provided in sections 549.191 and 549.20.
Do you have that? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Hang on, Senator Limmer. Senator Higgins, did that take care of your motion? You had said that we had failed to delete something else that was taken care of in the
That amendment. Was in that same item 3. And so if that motion included deleting everything to the end of that item 3, then I think we were taken care of.
That will be incorporated into that motion. Sorry. Senator Limmer?
So that's it for the A3 amendment. If anybody has any more questions on the items in the A3 amendment sections.
Anyone else?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you. Madam Chair, could I get a definition on page two, line two, of an open-end credit plan? I don't know if that's defined in your
in the amendment, on the A3 amendment? Oh. On the A3 amendment, line 2.2.
Yeah, there's a reference to an open-end credit plan. I don't know what that is. And do we have a definition of what that is?
Ms. Hawkins, did you say that this whole section was in reference to jumbo loans?
Madam Chair, that's correct. That this definition was plucked from.
We took that out.
Did we remove that?
It's probably a line of credit.
Plucked from some industry reference point. Some of the industry folks we were working with suggested this language as what they recognize to be the jumbo loan definition.
And we're carving out an exception from application of this section to jumbo loans as defined here. Correct, Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And an open-ended credit plan, in response to Senator Limmer's question, is a plan, could be a revolving line of credit, a home equity loan that doesn't start and end with one transaction.
Okay. Sure. I can understand that.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Cox could answer this one, too. In both sections, we're creating, well, let's just take Section 6. We create remedies in Subdivision 1 and private attorney general remedies in Subdivision 2. What does Subdivision 2 give that Subdivision 1 doesn't?
Professor Cox?
Senator Madam Chair, Senator Neville, and I haven't been here all day, so my apologies. The addition of the private attorney general statute was the idea of a couple of people on the predatory lending study group to add in the remedies that are available in Section 8.31. The answer is probably not a lot, but 8.31 subdivision 3A does say, for instance, or other equitable relief. So you have a statutory injunctive and statutory equitable remedy. There's also case law under the private attorney general statute that could be used to define what those remedies are that wouldn't exist at the time you put in this new private right of action. The answer is it's not. I don't think that is critical, to be honest, but there was concern that we also add in that known quantity of a private right of action as well.
And, Madam Chair, Mr.
Cox,
what's the significance of that last sentence in Subdivision 2, that the right of action is in the public interest?
Professor Cox.
I guess I haven't seen that.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, for a full explication of that, there's a brilliant article in the recent William Mitchell Law Review article.
Written by a
middle-aged professor from the University of Minnesota Law School.
We amend that.
There's a decision by the Supreme Court in 2000 called Levy-Nystrom that imposed what's called the public benefit test on the use of the private attorney general action. It's actually had the effect of completely eliminating individuals' rights to use the private right of action. So basically every individual plaintiff, and there's one here today sitting over there who had a mortgage fraud case, has been dismissed under this test. This is an attempt to make clear that that the use of this provision by an individual borrower would survive that leaving Nystrom test that was imposed.
Okay. I'll review the case. I'm not familiar with it.
Well, Madam Chair, on that point, do we need that sentence in this bill to make the bill do what we want? Is that important to have?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I think the point that's being made is that if we want to leave in the private attorney general remedy, then we have to have that sentence. Otherwise, we lose that. So we have to have the sentence to make it effective.
Okay. All right. Senator Higgins, the A4 amendment.
Do you want to adopt the A3 amendment first?
Yeah.
All right. So. We have to. Any further discussions on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. That was a Higgins motion.
Thank you very much. The A4 amendment, Madam Chair, deals with the penalties, and Ms. Hawkins probably knows best as well, so I'll turn it over to her again.
Ms. Hawkins.
Very bad.
Madam Chair, the some of you may who sit on the Commerce Committee may recall when this bill first came up in the Commerce Committee, senators raised concerns about the way the bill originally referred to the criminal portion of violating of basically committing mortgage fraud. The bill started out by calling the criminal piece making a grossly unsuitable loan, and contained a penalty of imprisonment of up to 2 years and a $75,000 fine. Members of the Commerce Committee and also members of the industry expressed concern about the way that whole section was written. And so this new language represents a compromise agreement that was reached with the Association of Mortgage Brokers, the authors, and the advocates working on this bill. And it was also really an attempt to address the concerns raised by senators. We've also worked with Senate counsel on refining this standard even more. Basically, it now is a provision that will be in the criminal code in section 609.822. It is now called residential mortgage fraud rather than a grossly unsuitable criminal penalty. The two provisions here that would essentially constitute mortgage fraud, if you look at lines 1.30 to 2.3, basically intentionally making a misstatement or misrepresentation or omission during the mortgage lending process with the intention that it be relied upon in the making of a loan. And the second provision would be knowingly using or facilitating the use of such a statement in the obtaining of a mortgage loan. In other words, if it's the person who's filling out the forms and they're committing fraud in that act, that's going to violate this provision. And then secondly, even if you're not the person who filled out the forms, but you're using those forms and submitting them knowing that there's fraud contained in those documents, that would also violate the provision. The language, or the sentence now, rather than having its own independent penalties, this bill now ties the penalty to an existing statute, which is the theft statute, 609.52. That way the court can look to the value of the benefit wrongfully obtained or the economic loss of the borrower, and then go into an existing criminal statute for determination of the adequate penalty. In subdivision 4, the original bill had an additional penalty of up to 2 years in prison and $50,000. What this provision does is basically there's already an existing provision in criminal law that says you can a prosecutor can seek an enhancement of the penalty if the crime is done against a vulnerable person. So the bill now just adopts that existing standard and encourages prosecutors to make sure to check that angle. And those represent the main changes that have been done here. And again, this is something that was worked on very closely with the industry folks, particularly the Mortgage Brokers Association. And they, Mr. Martin is here, but I think I can speak for him to say that they support a criminal penalty. They want to send a strong message that fraud in mortgage lending will not be tolerated, and we worked very hard to try to get a standard that was clear and that everybody could accept and understand.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Do the members have any questions?
Senator
Betzel?
I've got a very technical one on page 2 on lines 211 or 212. Is a particularly vulnerable victim different from a vulnerable victim? Senator Higgins is
Ms. Hawkins?
Yeah. I was hoping, Madam Chair, I was hoping that Mr. Backus could help answer that question.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, I think you got me on that one.
I think just so we can keep the statutes yes. a little bit smaller than they need to be. I'll move on page 2, line 11 and 12, just to delete the word particularly. I think if you're vulnerable, you're vulnerable, and I don't know if you're particularly vulnerable. That makes any difference.
Senator Betzel moves on line 2.111 that we delete the word particularly. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
2.12 as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess it's
1 and 2, 11 and 12.
On lines 111 and 2.112.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. Let me double check. I believe I'm sure I got that language from the sentencing guidelines. If you let me double check, I think that's the exact language from the sentencing guidelines. Oh. If you'd give me a minute. I just remember that.
Okay. Could I ask a question?
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, while we're on that particular area, page 2.
This particular area.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Page just
2,
on that area.
Line 13, vulnerability due to age. Does that mean older age, younger age? Could it be a first-time home buyer versus a that might be 19 years of age, or are we talking of someone to the intent to be put in statute? Are we really talking of someone that may be older?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I would like to defer to Mr. Backus again, please.
Madam Chair and members, yes, this language is basically taken verbatim from the sentencing guidelines relating to aggravating factors. So that's exactly how it reads, that that if a person knew that the victim was particularly vulnerable due to age, infirmity, et cetera, that's yeah.
Particularly.
Yes, sir.
I'll withdraw my motion. Although,
well, why don't we change the sentencing guidelines thing instead?
And it said due to age. Also?
Yes, Senator.
Is it advanced age?
Nope.
Any other discussions on the A4 Amendment, Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, does the language of this A4 Amendment put, a title insurance agent who's doing a closing at risk if at the closing the buyer says, oh, that's not true? They better stop the closing, or they're guilty of fraud too, even though they didn't prepare any of the documents? I mean, I guess they would have prepared maybe the HUD-1. So they'll be responsible. It'll be their duty to stop the closing.
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, this, in answer to your question, if we look at as that was described to me by some prosecutors, They would have to meet all of these criteria of, you know, first, I think as you indicate, Senator Neville, knowingly using or facilitating the use of the statement, which they would be doing if they said, let's use it anyway, I guess. And then you would get, they would have to know that it was a deliberate and a material misstatement also. And then they would also have to intend that it be relied upon by the mortgage lender or whoever it was that they were providing that to. And so I think if the title agent, for example, knew that there was fraud in the document and they intended, they would have to deliberately submit that document to the lender, and they would have to intend that the lender rely on that document, they would be guilty under this section.
Okay.
Senator Limmer.
Well, Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Senator Neville.
So we're going to put closers at, impose a due diligence on them, or as a practical matter, what are they going to do? If there's any inkle that that the borrower, if the borrower says, well, I'm not sure that's true anymore, I mean, they have a duty then to stop? I mean, as a practical matter, what will happen? They didn't prepare any of those, you know, underwriting documents. They didn't do any appraisal reports or loan applications or supporting all they're doing is showing the HUD one that somebody else prepared, maybe they did, and getting signatures and doing everything. I mean, what will be the duty to inquire of a closer or a title insurance agent, do you think?
Ms. Hawkins?
Maybe Mr. Cox can answer that.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I litigated mortgage cases on behalf of legal aid clients for several years, and Mr. Cox, I know, has litigated many cases involving mortgages, and it's common for title companies, especially, I guess, some of the more fly-by-night title companies, to have had some involvement in mortgage fraud cases. And so in many cases I've seen, the fraud couldn't have happened without some assistance from the title agent. And so, you know, the burden of foreclosures and all the problems that are upon us is not just a result of the lenders and brokers and borrowers themselves, but everyone involved in this process. And so if a title agent knew that there was fraud in a document and intended to deliberately submit that document to the lender or to the borrower, and intended for that document to be relied upon by whoever was going to use it, they would be held liable here.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville,
let me ask a hypothetical. This isn't an area that I know much about, frankly, but in our community, we do a lot of community land trust transactions. In fact, my office closed one today. I should have been the one doing it. Somebody else did. But typically on a lot of those things, the land trust keeps the land, and the cost for the building is financed 100%. And, in fact, more than that, because there's might be a third loan that covers the closing costs too. So the person who's buying puts almost, well, no money into the loan. Is that type of thing going to be caught by this bill?
Ms. Hawkins?
And the land trust transactions, let me supplement it, they're designed to go to low-income persons who otherwise couldn't buy a house, and so they don't have to pay for the cost of the land. They get, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 lower price, and they don't have to finance the land. but some of them are just right on the line, even just paying for the building. Will this predatory lending bill put a kibosh on things, on low affordable housing programs like that, where they're being 100% financed with marginal borrowers?
Well, Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, the criminal provisions here apply only to residential mortgage loans, so it would have to be, in the first place, a loan that somebody was going to use to buy a house to live in. In a larger, deal, acquisition of land or the beginnings of the trust process, it wouldn't apply to those loans.
Well, land trust loans are residential loans. They're buying houses.
Right, but, well, I'll look up the definition here of a residential mortgage loan, but I'm not sure at that stage that you're referring to, it would be considered a residential mortgage loan. Are you talking about?
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's not take the committee time. Can you get me the answer to that, or come and talk to me? Because the reason I'm asking is that, frankly, I think these community land trust things are the best affordable housing programs that exist in Minnesota. They should be everywhere because it allows the money to be recycled. But it strikes me that a lot of these things have first mortgages, second mortgages, and third. The one I did today for our office, three mortgages. Mm-hmm. And the person put no money into it, and they're marginal borrowers because they've got very low income. And they're residential, and I'm afraid that this might affect them. But I'd like you to get me an answer to that.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I guess my understanding, though, is that we're not doing anything that prohibits some prime loans from being made. We're just saying that there are certain practices you can't engage in when you're making them, and holding the lenders or people associated with this, like the closers, responsible for fraudulent practices. And I would think that if they knew there was inaccurate information that was going to go forward with a loan, that whether they're the closer or the lender or whomever they may be in the process, that they should be bringing that they shouldn't be proceeding with the loan when they know there's inaccurate information that is being relied upon.
Senator Lummer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hawkins, while you're doing a little research for Senator Neville, I was just wondering, there are other types of ownership for a condo-like building called a cooperative. And you're, instead of buying the physical aspects of a space, you're buying a share of value in basically a corporation that owns the building, and you own a proportional share of that. Does this bill cover a cooperative sale? Or I've never done one, so I don't know. But I just want to know, because that technically is not a sale of real estate. You're selling a share in a corporate entity that gives you the right to use that unit of residence.
Ms. Hawkins?
Mortgage. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm not sure about the answer to that question. Okay. Maybe Mr. Cox knows for sure whether cooperative buy-ins are considered residential mortgage loans under our statute.
So. I should think so. Looking up some
stuff. Ms. Hawkins, in the amendment on point subdivision 3 for the sentence, I'm getting the feeling that the spread of the potential penalty is anywhere from a misdemeanor to potentially a 20-year felony. Am I misreading that? The continuum of potential penalties under that section?
Madam Chair, you're not misreading that. That would be correct.
What line are you on?
Page 2, subdivision 3. And what's the rationale for that, Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, the original bill set a $75,000 penalty and up to 2 years of imprisonment. And the goal here was really to tie it to an existing statute that imposes criminal penalties rather than sort of making up our own in the original bill. And so 60952 is really the only comparable place that we identified where we could refer the court over and then have the court do its own analysis given all the circumstances.
Well, that feels a little bit loosey-goosey in terms of letting the court do the analysis without providing some guidance on how to anchor them, given how big that continuum is. And I mean, maybe I'm the only one who has some concerns about that, but I don't know how to suggest something. I was just a little bit this committee works very hard to try to define and pinpoint and crystallize certain things so that we don't create a lot of ambiguities, and I have some concerns about how far that spread is, and I don't have a suggestion yet, but I would want you to think about that. I think I've raised this concern earlier, and I don't know how to really address that unless other members in the committee might have the same reaction and might have some ideas.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer?
What is 609.52 sub 3? What is that reference?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, yes, that's the theft sentencing provision, the general theft law.
But the question is it really... Is it theft? I don't know if it technically is. Let's take the extreme. I'm trying to help. If I'm a lender, and I'm trying to help someone get a loan, and I've got a great loan program that might be an adjustable rate mortgage that I'm offering to a client, and I specify all of the risks to them, have them sign documents that state it in clear 14-point type, do everything I possibly can with the absolute intent to give them a loan to allow them to acquire a home. And for some reason, a court somewhere down the road is going to say, I shouldn't have given them that loan. And does that... I guess the question is, did I knowingly do anything that put them in a bad position? But is that theft? I don't know if I'm taking anything away from that individual. Does it qualify under that definition? I don't know if it is or not. Let's say I'm even knowingly trying to get them into a loan just for the benefit of whatever profit I make on the mortgage. Is that the loss? Is the loss on their failure to make payment? Did they lose any equity value? Did they not? Is it a missed opportunity that if I would have been a little bit more practical in trying to analyze their needs, I might have suggested, maybe you should have bought a house $50,000 less. But I have this great opportunity for you that you could take the risk that the adjustable rate mortgage won't go up and after it goes past its lock-in period. And lo and behold, 7 years later, the lock-in period dissipates and the adjustable rate mortgage goes up 1.9 percentage points. And perhaps that person doesn't make the same income that they did 7 years ago when they originated the loan. Am I going to be... As a loan officer, am I going to be held responsible for theft for doing that? I don't know where we pinpoint that definition.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't think you're calling this theft. You're just saying the sentencing would be as provided in the theft statute. And I think the idea here is to tie it to the value of the damage to the party. So I don't think you're saying it's theft. but I don't know where else you would tie it.
But
they're losing $50,000 or $150,000.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
if we set the sentence as provided in the theft statute, mm-hmm. then one of the basic reference points is it a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony theft? And that's a financial threshold. And what is the financial threshold? Is it $150 or is it $500 that makes it a felony? And so that means that everything we write in here will be a felony under that statute reference, that 609.52, because houses certainly are the potential loss of this individual. And I'm not even sure how you quantify the loss right now, especially in a time when you might have dwindling equity values in a property. So is everyone who would be found guilty of that a felony, going to be sentenced under a felony theft, but sentence? But where is the rationale for the sentence? Usually every sentence we have, it's a violation of theft, swindle, any other host of criminal statutes that we define what the crime is, and then we have a sentence that is supposed to be proportional to that crime. Now we're not even really recognizing a criminal statute in definition. We're just saying whatever this is that they're found wrongdoing on, we're going to borrow that sentence over there under theft. And, of course, everything that's under that is a felony. So I don't know. It seems a little sloppy to me.
Ben? How do you determine the amount? Going on the assumption that this is comparable, we use the theft amounts as a guide for the crime, as suggested by Senator Scheid. I can buy that. I mean, I could stretch to thinking about this being comparable to. So how do we determine the amount? You're saying that the court determines that amount of what that damage is that would then trigger whatever theft crime this becomes, Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, in subdivision 3, subsection 1, it directs the court to consider, in terms of value, the value of the property, services, or other benefit wrongfully obtained, or the aggregate economic loss suffered by the person as a result of the violation. And those would be the guideposts for the court.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I mean, I hate to say anything that would be causing a problem for this bill, but to me this is really vague and confusing. Because when you say the value of the property, are you talking about the property that this person was able to purchase because of a loan that shouldn't have been made? Or are you talking about the value of the amount that the mortgage lender was able to charge as a fee that was wrongful because they're the ones who did something wrong? I mean, I think it's really too ambiguous to talk about, you know, what usually property in the context of something like this, especially you'd be thinking that you were talking about like real property, but I just think that's confusing.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, can you answer that? I think that's a key question.
Mm-hmm.
What is the intent of the value of the property? What do you mean to say by that?
Ms. Hawkins or Professor Cox?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I think the intent of that is whatever it was that was wrongfully obtained. And in most of these cases, it would likely be a mortgage loan itself that would not have been obtained but for the fraud.
So, Madam Chair, so the value of the property is the amount of the loan. Is that the intent?
Ms. Hawkins?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, that would likely be the result, I think, in most cases.
Well, Madam Chair, then
Senator Neville?
Your concern that there'll be a misdemeanor is, you don't have to worry about that. Every single one will be the maximum theft theft conviction that we have on the books, I suspect.
And Senator Neville, that would be Ms. Backus, a 20-year felony?
Yeah, and that seems like overkill.
That's why I was a little bit concerned of this section, and I...
Madam Chair,
we
have two suggestions for you.
Okay.
The other would be to go back to the old language. That's the $75,000 or 2 years. That's in the first engrossment. Or the other option is to delete on the A4 amendment the one or the two.
One.
Starting on line 2.8, delete the parens 1, the value of the property, services, or other benefit wrongfully obtained or attempted to obtain, or, and then just make it, it would be based on the aggregate economic loss suffered by any person as a result of the violation.
That's better.
So there's two options for you, whichever you would like to do.
I see members in the committee nodding on that second option, Senator Higgins.
Okie dokie.
Senator Higgins moves to delete on line 2.8, starting with the.
This time of the night, you bet it is.
And going on to line 2.9, ending after the number two parentheses. Is that it?
You could get rid of the one.
Get rid of the parentheses.
And Madam Chair, you can get rid of the greater of as well. So based on the aggregate economic loss.
On that motion,
such.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Senator Limmer.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, we have an answer for your question about the co-ops. They are considered a residential mortgage loan according to Chapter 58.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer.
The aggregate economic loss that we're now recognizing, doesn't that still basically recognize a value that would still put us at a 20-year felony?
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Remember that Senator Neville had a bill that we have in our omnibus public safety bill that doubles all of the numbers for that very same section.
Well, let's see. In that section...
Senator Limmer.
Under 609.52, imprisonment for not more than 20 years or to a payment of a fine of not more than $100,000. So now it'd be.
No, we didn't double that.
Or if the property, well, it's not a firearm, or the value of the property is more than $35,000. So
Chair,
have we moved that?
So now that becomes 70.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. Now that we've changed to the aggregate economic loss and not tied it to the value of the property, there certainly are situations. I mean, every situation is not going to be a total loss. If a person loses their home because the mortgage foreclosure causes them to be out $10,000, then they'll only have the penalty that would be equivalent to $10,000, not based on the value of the whole home of $100,000. So it'll be tied to their actual loss, not to the value of the property, is the way I understand it now.
All right. Senator Higgins, on line 2.16, after the word section, you would want to move to insert an is.
I was listening elsewhere, Madam Chair. Where are you talking?
Line 2.16.
Section is not a
bar. After the word section, you want to insert the word is.
That's a good change there, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moves that change. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Backus informs me that deleting the words particularly vulnerable it would not be offensive to the sentencing guidelines. So we could delete particularly lines 2.11 and 2.12 and sentencing guidelines will figure out the rest.
So particularly on line 2.12?
11 and 12.
Back to particularly again.
Okay.
That's just head notes.
Sentencing guidelines will work if we believe particularly.
Head notes don't count.
Senator Higgins, are you all right with that? On that motion.
I am particularly fine with that.
On Senator Betzel's particular motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
There's got to be a such in here prevails. Somewhere that we could do the Denny Fredrickson amendment on somewhere.
And then last question, Ms. Hawkins. What's the intent behind other convictions not barred? What are we contemplating that you could still go after them for?
What else can you do?
I'm getting my second wind.
It's that fish you had.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. It's the answer.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I don't know. The concept was part of the original amendment. I just added a head note and changed a little bit. I assume it, you know, it's meant that if there's any other crimes committed as part of the same course of conduct, you could prosecute. You know, what those crimes would be, I don't exactly know.
Senator Betzel moves to strike subdivision 5.
Yeah. Madam Chair, what's the notwithstanding on there?
Pardon me?
What are we notwithstanding? In that section.
That 04 means...
Senator Foley?
16904 deals with the multiple charging of penalties.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I mean, basically it's the exemption to the double jeopardy, so you'd be able to get more than one offense. If you're going to delete subdivision 5, then you'd also want to delete section 8 on line 1. Because those two are related concepts.
Who what?
On page 1 of the amendment, the new section 8, lines 1.4 to 1.13, is connected with that subdivision.
Oh, I see.
Ms. Hawkins, Professor Cox?
Well, wouldn't there be occasionally multiple charges?
Senator Higgins?
I mean, I don't know this stuff very well, Madam Chair, but wouldn't there be occasion where there could be multiple charges that should be charged for, you know, for these kinds of offenses?
Well, Senator Higgins, that's why I was wondering, and that's why I asked Ms. Hawkins, but she says she doesn't know what that could potentially be. And if we don't have a particular situation that we're contemplating...
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel?
Senator Olson just suggested, for instance, you could have a much more serious offense being committed, a racketeering, you know, money laundering, something that's going
mail
on.
Mail fraud.
And if you charge under this one, you may not be able to charge the more serious offense. So I think that, so you know, maybe that might be some rationale for keeping it in.
Conspiracy charges as well?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sending your check by mail, that's always a good one.
Okay. Well,
so let's leave them in, Madam Chair.
That's fine. Then Section 8, Subdivision 1, those cross-references to those particular sections, though, I'd ask Mr. Backus to explain what each of those references was to, and it's like to kidnapping and... Ms. Backus, can you just tell us what those references are?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's offenses such as arson, firearms offenses, fleeing a peace officer, criminal sexual conduct offenses. These are, you know, when you commit, say, a criminal sexual conduct and in the same course of conduct, you commit other crimes. So kidnapping, burglary, criminal vehicle operation, crimes against unborn children, crimes wearing bulletproof vests, solicitation of juveniles, and use of police radios to commit a crime.
So, Senator Higgins, that's why I thought it – that's why I wanted to know what the rationale was for potentially what the other crimes could be. Now, racketeering makes sense. Mm-hmm. Kidnapping doesn't.
No. Well, Madam Chair, maybe we can try and figure out what those need to be before I get to the floor or, you know, for a floor amendment.
If it's part of the same
Okay.
If that'd be all right.
Okay, I'll sign.
That will be fine. And I would think that you probably would want to revisit that Section 8, because I don't know how that particularly would apply to this.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hawkins?
The Section 8, Subdivision 1, and Mr. Backus may want to comment on this, but that is just the introductory part of existing law, and it's where it just happens to exist where he placed, or Senate Counsel placed this particular crime. I'm guessing if we decided to put this somewhere else in 609, that Subdivision 1 wouldn't be there.
Okay. Oh, I see. That's the number. There. Oh.
Senator Neville?
Well, Madam Chair, now the mortgage fraud is serious, and we're going to allow aggravation, but I don't know that it's that much more serious than a lot of other property or financial crimes. And I would favor taking Section 8 and Subdivision 5 out of it. Now, one prosecution should be enough. If there's a more serious one, the prosecutor can charge multiple counts in the same complaint and then get sentenced for the more serious one.
Unless, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, unless you didn't know about the racketeering or money laundering, and then you charge and maybe even get a conviction, maybe the guy pleads guilty quickly, the first one, and you realize that it's much, much bigger. Did you preempt the opportunity to go after him on the other ones?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair.
Well, members, I think that it'll be a better argument for Senator Higgins to say, in carrying out the concerns of the Judiciary Committee, she has thought better of it, and she wants to delete this on the floor than to say the Judiciary Committee took it out and she wants to add it back in on the floor. So Senator Higgins will continue to look at this, give her some feedback. If it seems like it's something that's appropriate, you will look to the committee's wishes, and you could take it, would be willing to take it out on the floor if that's what's appropriate. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, we did a lot of work on these amendments today, and let me take the opportunity to thank Mr. Backus and Ms. Pontius both for working so hard on these today. But that's not to say that there still isn't some refinement that we can do. So,
right. And Madam Chair?
Senator Scheib.
Madam Chair, if I could just bring us back to the underlying issue here. I mean, people have lost their homes, their life's investment. They've lost everything, and many people without the hope of ever having another or owning another home. So the crime of mortgage fraud, I think it's long overdue, or at least overdue by some years here, and we should keep that in mind when we're thinking about the sentencing and the ability to prosecute for other crimes as well.
Very good.
So, Madam Chair, let me move the A4 amendment as amended.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I have one more amendment I'd like to propose to Subdivision 4, page 2, line 11. As I look at the rest of the language, I don't know that we need to be telling the prosecutors what they have to consider. I think the intent here is that we want the court to be able to consider this as an aggravation. So what I'd like to propose is that on page 2, line 11, we delete the words prosecutor determines that. Then on line 213, delete prosecutor and insert court. And on line 214, delete the first three words and insert may order. So what this will say now is what it would say if this amendment passes is we also have to take out the A. If the person who violates Subdivision 2 knew or had reason to know that the victim was vulnerable due to age, infirmity, reduced physical or mental capacity, to the court may order an aggravated departure.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that's what we intend to do.
Right. Senator Higgins?
Sounds good.
Yeah. On Senator Neville's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Senator Higgins moves the A4 amendment as amended. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, let me talk to you a little bit about, I think it goes to the floor. Mr. Turner had a preliminary fiscal note here, and it was based, the Commerce Department wanted two new people
and $150,000 a year to manage the list of where people could go get their counseling. Now, we've taken that out, so I think that should go away. We do have penalties in here, but as we've been talking today, we think that probably nobody will go to prison about this because they wouldn't have had other crimes that, you know, would get them up to a prison level. So I think going to the floor is probably the right place to go. And if anybody thinks differently, we can talk about that. But unless anybody disagrees with me on that, I'll move that the whatever the heck the number of this bill, Senate File 988,
as amended,
be recommended to pass and go to the floor.
Be referred to the Senate floor. Anyone else in the audience want to testify on this? See none. Any further discussions? On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shad.
Madam Chair, was adjourned to, I think we haven't located Senator Sparks. And I saw him here earlier this evening. Are you planning to take his bill now? I think there are people here.
I would like to
testify.
Senator
Chair,
Senate rules prohibit us taking up anything after 10 o'clock.
Madam Chair, Senator, I just looked it up. Rule 12.4 says that we must adjourn by 10 o'clock unless two-thirds of the committee agree to go beyond it.
Well, I was hoping members of the committees wouldn't raise that. Then we wouldn't have to look for two-thirds of the committee members. I'm disappointed that Senator Sparks can't be here. Perhaps he's caught up somewhere else. I feel badly for the people who are here. I think that out of deference for Senator Bach, who came to me today on the floor, saying that the industries, both manufacturers as well as the retailers, have been willing to go and work with him on putting this bill together. I felt strongly that what is a judiciary issue should be worked out in the Judiciary Committee if the stakeholders were intending to work out this deal in another committee. And I think that we have been more than fair to the bills that have come through this committee. Members of this committee do good work, and we are more than willing to accommodate authors and stakeholders to make sure that the bills get to where it needs to get to. And when Senator Bach said that he needed to have this bill in the Tax Committee, I felt that it was important to respect that and give this bill an expeditious hearing as possible. And so even given how lengthy our agenda was tonight, I gave it priority so that we can get it to the Tax Committee. Again, I'm not going to send something to the Tax Committee with judicial provisions not having been worked out or looked upon by this committee. And I didn't think that was Senator Bach's request. I didn't think it was his intent for us to just cursory look at it and send it to his committee so that they could address the tax implications as well as the judiciary issues in that committee. So it is up to the will of this committee, but I have to say that I see a number of people in the audience who've been here all night waiting with us to have this bill heard, and I would like to accommodate them. But I don't know whether we could do that if your author is not here. So, Senator Scheid?
I'm sure. I guess I'm a co-author on this. I'd be willing to sit there and present the bill. I don't have notes on it, but I know we have someone with expertise in the area of the bill and franchise law in particular. So, and I think there are people to testify. So I'd be willing to do that. I do want to share with you that I knew that Senator Bach wanted the bill out of Commerce, but I knew the committee knew there were judiciary issues that needed to be resolved first, and that's why we sent it here first. And I agree with you entirely that we should be doing that in this committee.
Well, Senator Shad, I appreciate that, and I'll tell you that both Senator Bach and Senator Sparks, as well as the stakeholders in this bill, knew me a long time ago that I wanted to be respectful of Senator Bach's request and the work that had been done in the Commerce Committee. And I asked that in order to help us along, that the two sides get together and try to come up with some resolution to the conflict so that we could schedule the bill and we can move it along. And when Senator Bach approached me today and said, you only have one committee meeting left, and are you going to hear that bill? I said, well, I haven't heard anything back from the people who are working on this. And he said, well, he was frankly surprised. Well, I am too. I very much would like to accommodate authors and other committees, and when that doesn't happen, it puts us in this situation where we've run out of time. But I still do want to accommodate. It's up to the will of this committee. People have been here all night, and I like to help them. So we could, you know, I mean, I was hoping the issue wouldn't be raised, but now that the issue has been raised, we have to decide if 2/3 majority of this committee will be willing to stay beyond, and I would ask that. I would ask that we accommodate the people who've been here, so.
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, is it possible to hear from them? If you, I mean, I don't know what, I know you're meeting tomorrow because we're going to be here at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and
how many bills do we have?
I don't know. I assume that schedule or that agenda is lengthy as well. You might be able to hear from some people here. I know Mr. Dady, though, has the expertise that we need, I think.
Well, let's hear from members of the public. Would you like to be heard tonight, or would you be willing to, if we can fit you in tomorrow, we could certainly try to accommodate you tomorrow afternoon.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Buzz Anderson, President of the Retailers, and I appreciate your indulgence. Our chief witness cannot be here tomorrow and made great attempts to be here tonight. So I would really appreciate the committee's indulgence if we could at least hear from him. He has an expertise in franchise law. This is what that does deal with. And I do have witnesses from out of town, although they don't have to testify. They were actually here to answer questions. So.
And will they be able to be available tomorrow? And I do apologize to them.
In the morning? Are you thinking in the morning, Madam Chair?
I'm not sure. We have a couple of bills in the morning that I don't know what the time would be. But if we do recess, it will be just to go to the floor session, and then we would restart around 12:30 or 1 o'clock.
Yeah, we could have at least one here, Madam Chair.
Maybe we should vote.
But our chief witness could not be here.
Madam Chair, maybe we should vote to see what the intent of the committee is.
Well, why don't we just have a conversation among the committee members? I mean, what is your desire? I'd like to hear from the witness who can't be here tomorrow, at least.
Madam Chair,
if you'll accommodate me for that. And then if we go a little bit longer tomorrow because we, you know, want to make time to accommodate this bill, that... I mean, certainly, to do that tomorrow afternoon is far better than going into the hours in the evening.
Madam Chair, I'll make the motion that we continue the meeting, and I'll make the motion to at least to adjourn by 10:30 for the purpose of hearing any witnesses who cannot be back tomorrow. I'm a bit uncomfortable proceeding without the chief author here, but I don't want to put any witnesses who've been waiting around all night cannot come back tomorrow. I want to hear what their testimony is as well, too. But I'd like to get the chief author here if we're going to start acting on the bill.
I would, too. And
he isn't here, so.
But for deference to Senator Bach, who have asked that we send this bill to him and the work the Commerce Committee has done, and out of respect for the public who's been here waiting all night, I would lay this bill on the table and it might not come back. But I do appreciate that you've reassembled your schedule to be here. So let's vote on Senator Betzel's motion, and I hope that you will...
Would you restate the motion?
To continue the meeting until at no later than 10:30. That is, we adjourn by or before 10:30.
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, members, this bill deals with franchise law as it relates to motorsports dealers. It would provide the same protection to motorsports dealers as it does for implement dealers, automobile dealers, and large machinery dealers. Those laws have been on the books in Minnesota for a lot of years. without spending a lot of time talking about it beyond that, I think the concern of the committee, and I don't want to speak for the committee, has been the fact that the bill does provides that a dealership cannot be taken away from a motorsports dealer without good cause. And my witness here tonight is to talk about the eight provisions in the bill that define good cause. And he's an expert in this area, so I'll introduce Michael Dady and let him speak to that, if that's okay with you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Dady, welcome to the committee, and thank you so much for making the time to be here, and I apologize that we've kept you so late.
Not at all, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, thank you so much for making this a late evening and allowing me the opportunity to talk about what has consumed my professional life now for the last 32 years. I'm here to tell you all that good things and bet.
Yes, ma'am. Are you just a professional franchise agreement expert, or are you associated with any other organization or entity that we should know about?
I'm a franchisee lawyer. I've been representing franchisees and dealers for 32 years. I'm the principal shareholder of Dady & Garner, which is a boutique law firm that has a national practice representing franchisees and dealers around the country. And I've been asked to be a participating author in statutes that have been enacted to protect franchisees and dealers in Minnesota and elsewhere. I was probably the principal draftsperson of the 1988 enactment of the Minnesota Agricultural Equipment Dealers Act, and that act was subsequently essentially duplicated a few years later and became the Minnesota Heavy Construction Equipment Dealers Act. And those two statutes have been the pattern for other statutes that have been enacted in maybe a dozen states around the country. I want to hesitate to add, however, that I'm a living embodiment of that thought, that there's no such thing as an original thought in the law, because the statute that I drafted was in fact cut and pasted from other statutes that were in place around the country protecting equipment dealers. But I've been working with these statutes since at least the early 80s, and that's my professional involvement.
Very good. We'll take your testimony. Thank you.
I appreciate that. And I got in this line of work because my father, whom I thought was a good dealer, got terminated. He calls me up as I'm graduating from law school, says, "Hey, Michael, you're a lawyer almost. Can you help me with this problem?" And so because of that family involvement, I got interested in specializing in this, and I've worked in it now for this is my 32nd year. It's been my experience that statutes tend to get passed as the result of a crisis occurring in particular industries, that there has to be some attention-getting event that causes legislators to take time from their busy schedules to say this is not a hypothetical problem, but it's a serious problem. And indeed, the genesis for the 1988 enactment was a crisis involving the Lano family out in the Shakopee area. They were terminated. They had the number one salesman in the United States of Bobcat, Melrose Bobcats, but because of the manufacturer's interest in changing the way in which it was doing business, they received a termination notice and decided to fight it, and got a lot of publicity, got the attention of the legislators, and they said, you know, we really are about protecting family businesses that are doing a good job, paying their bills, helping, working with their manufacturer to build the value of the brand for the benefit of the manufacturer, the retailer, and doing a good job serving the consumers. So the legislature asked me to participate in that effort, and as a result of the crisis that was occurring in the Lano family at that time, the 88 statute was enacted. It's also the case that actually it was my father's case. It also involved several beer distributors in Minnesota. It was the genesis for the Minnesota Wholesale Beer Distributor Statute that's been enacted here to protect beer wholesalers against termination without a good cause. At the time of my father's termination in 1975, there were only about 10 state statutes protecting beer wholesalers. There are now 49 states that have such statutes. So it's a very common thing around the country, and it's certainly been the consistent spirit of the Minnesota legislature to enact statutes to say good dealers deserve to be protected. And I think it's a well-known fact, certainly my experience, that the written agreements in place are not sufficient to protect dealers against unfair conduct. The franchisors have all the bargaining power. the agreements are typically presented on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. And so really some bad things have happened in my experience over the years to dealers absent statutory protection. So that's the genesis here. Several dealers asked their association to get involved and do for them, that is outdoor power equipment folks, and we're talking about ATVs and snowmobiles and watercraft, give us the same protection that's been available for 20 years for agricultural equipment dealers, for almost that long for heavy construction equipment dealers, since the about that same length of time for beer wholesalers. Car dealers have had this type of protection for probably 30 years. So it's a very common type of statute. And what's being proposed here in this statute is exactly the same, to my reading, as what was enacted in 1988. So one of the things I would ask if I was you folks is, well, how has that worked? I mean, have there been constitutional issues raised? Have there been problems where manufacturers can't end relationships with dealers who aren't paying their bill or who are devoting their time to promoting other brands, that type of thing? And from my experience, the statute has worked very well. The beer statute, the car statute, the ag statute, the heavy construction equipment statute, they don't say manufacturers' hands are tied, that they can't act in their best interest to make changes where dealers aren't doing the job. And we don't have, we tell dealers, we can't help all of you. If you're not doing the job, you get notice of that fact, and you still aren't performing, then the manufacturer has the legal right to act and the relationship. And that's as it should be. And this bill isn't proposing anything different than that. So the key provision from, I think, the perspective of the folks who are interested in having the same type of protection that this state has long offered for others is spelled out in the statute, in the good cause section. The principal point, if I might just direct the committee's attention, is 80G.02. It says, good cause required. No outdoor sport equipment manufacturer, and that term is defined earlier, directly or through an officer, agent, or employee may terminate, cancel, fail to renew, or substantially change the competitive circumstances of a dealership agreement without good cause. Good cause means failure by an outdoor sport equipment dealer to substantially comply with essential and reasonable requirements imposed upon the dealer by the dealership agreement if the requirements are not different from those requirements imposed on other similarly situated dealers by their terms. That's the exact same language I used back in 88 to protect farm equipment dealers, and that exact same language I took from the North Dakota Agricultural Equipment Dealers Act that has been in effect for much longer than that. And then this statute, like many others, goes on to say, in addition, so that general definition to me is really what's going to control most situations, but I believe this other language was added at request of manufacturers. It says, in addition, good cause exists whenever, and then I'm not going to go through these, but I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them. There's 8 specific examples of what, in my opinion, would meet the general definition of good cause up above, but they're specifically spelled out so that manufacturers know if somebody does something like they sell their business without getting the manufacturer's approval, for example, and attempt to transfer the franchise, that doesn't work. That constitutes good cause, et cetera. So there's those 8 specific provisions. Then the remedies are the type of remedies that you'd expect. If there's a violation, the aggrieved dealer can seek either injunctive relief to prevent a termination or money damages in the event there is a termination or other breach, and there's some other spelled out, plus attorney's fees. And that's very typical. And I would say that approximately these types of statutes, there's probably, roughly 18 to 20 states around the United States that have similar statutes, some of which expressly apply to outdoor power equipment dealers, others such as Wisconsin, which have generic definitions of dealer that would include these types of dealers. But here in Minnesota, we don't have that situation, and that's what this statute is seeking to address. So hopefully that was about the right amount of comments given the hour, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
Any questions for the witness from the members? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, I was part of another committee that spent a long time, seems like a long time ago now, listening to the testimony on this bill. And there were some things in that committee, and just to kind of cut to the chase of what happened there, there were some concerns that both parties had about balancing this and making it more fair and more balanced. And there were going to be some conversations, I thought, between the dealers and the manufacturers to perhaps look for a way to make this a more fair and balanced piece of legislation. Is there anything that's been changed from the way that this has initially been proposed by the dealers to accommodate the manufacturer's concerns, or have you not been able to find any areas where you could reach any compromise?
Senator Olson, I don't think Mr. Dady is going to be able to answer that question. If Senator Sparks was here, he would be able to answer that. But Mr. Anderson, would you be able to shed some light on whether or not there's been any?
Madam Chair, the bills are identical between the House and the Senate, except for one change that the House made in hearing. This is the bill as originally introduced, and you're right, during the committee we were asked to sit down. We have made email invitations, phone call invitations, personal invitations, and the other party can speak for themselves, the manufacturers, but they've not been willing to meet with us. So, you know, that's why we're here, is because we've not been able to facilitate that conversation. I'm sure they have their own reasons why. We've been more than willing to try to have that conversation. We just haven't been able to have it. It hasn't been our fault.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Could you determine if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to speak against this?
Ms. Anderson, do you have anyone else speaking in favor of the bill who's not going to be here tomorrow?
Well, I do have, I think one of the things you might hear from the opposition either today, tonight or tomorrow is that they don't terminate dealers. I think our witness here, Mr. Dady, could tell you that in fact does happen, and I do have a dealer in the state who was one of the top dealers in the state, and he was terminated. So if you'd like to hear from him, he won't be here tomorrow, but that's really the will of the committee.
Okay. Well, let's hear from him because he's not going to be here tomorrow, but to be fair, I'd like to give about 5 or 10 minutes comparable time for anybody from the manufacturers to present to us, unless you're going to be here tomorrow. But I think we'll create a little bit of a balance here for us to think about or to chew on.
Yes.
So, Mr. Day, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Steve Vandiputty from Brainerd, Minnesota.
Vandiputty. Can you spell that?
Vandeputte.
Thank you. Mr. Vandiputty, please give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair People. I won't be able to be here tomorrow. I think this is my fifth or sixth trip down here. This is an important bill for me. I'd like to tell you that it's been brought up to me on a couple occasions that the manufacturers don't terminate dealers. I have letters and correspondence with me, and Mr. Dady can testify that on a couple occasions I was told I would not be renewed, and eventually was not renewed, and in my opinion without just cause. If you have any questions, be happy to answer them. This is a good bill. It'll be better for the consumer. It'll make for stronger dealers. I would like to ask the committee members why, if the surrounding states around us have this type of law, why can't we? We're also, the corporation that I represent is also an automotive dealer. We're also a motorcycle dealer. We have these laws in place to protect us. If we're not renewed or terminated, whatever term you might want to use, in the car business with our street bikes, we're just asking to be treated like car dealers, motorcycle dealers, heavy equipment dealers. We're not asking for any special favors.
Savannah Pudim, Mr. Dady, stated that usually these type of issues arise out of a general crisis that, you know, leads the legislature to want to create protective legislation for a particular group of individuals, which is consistent with past actions that have been done by the legislature. And I wonder if you could share with us, in your experience, if what the particular crisis is. I understand about the dealership cancellation piece. Is there any other particular crises outside of that you would like to inform the committee?
Well, I think a couple of the manufacturers in the snowmobile business would like you to believe it's because of the lack of snow and it's going to hurt their business and everything, and it has really nothing to do with the snowmobile business. It has to do with the overall conditions of the power sports business because it's so competitive, and the manufacturers are fighting so hard for market share that whatever they think they can do to increase market share is what drives them to terminate the current dealer and find somebody else. I can assure you, you know, with black and white facts, that after I was not renewed as a Polaris dealer because they wanted an exclusive dealer that didn't sell competitive brands to increase market share, they've lost substantial market share. They went backwards. It has nothing to do with, if I can use the word, greed. They just, it's all about creating more market share. And if there's just cause to be terminated, if I didn't pay my bills or I misrepresented the company or I committed some type of fraud, and any other dealer, I think they should be terminated. But if you're going to terminate me without good cause just because you want more market share, then buy the product back and give it to the other dealer. That's all we're asking. If you don't want us for a dealer, buy the product back and sell it to somebody else. Don't leave us hanging with it. I don't think that's too much to ask.
Any other questions for the witness? Senator Olson?
Madam Chair and Mr. Vandeputty, as you know, we've talked about this several times, and I'm very sympathetic to the dealers in my district and the difficulties that they've faced. The concern I have in terms of balancing it is I'm not sure that this bill does what you just said. In other words, if they didn't have to have good cause, you're saying then if they're going to terminate you, they should have to buy things back. But what this bill seems to do is it says they have to have good cause plus they have to buy this back if they terminate it because of good cause. So that's where I was hoping, I think we were looking at trying to get together in terms of a fair balance, because if they have to have good cause in order to terminate, which this bill says they must, which means that you've done something like maybe moved your business to a location that was different than what the contract agreement said it would be or something like that, then it seems like it says they still would have, if they use that good cause language to terminate, they would still have to buy back the equipment. Or am I misreading this? And I thought that was the problem, that it's kind of having it both ways under the language, the way it exists in this bill.
Again, Senator Olson, I think what I know that you want Mr. Vandeputty to respond. I think the value of his testimony is his experience with his business. And so in the interest of time, I would like Mr. Anderson, if Mr. Vandeputty and Mr. Dady are not going to be here tomorrow, can you make a note of Senator Olson's concern and make sure that we address that tomorrow?
Okay.
All right. Senator Scheib.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to ask Mr. Vandeputty, and it's good to see you again. Thank you for coming down. You spoke to us in the Commerce Committee. Can you tell me what then happened to the product you had once you were terminated or not renewed? And does the manufacturer warranty still apply, and are you able to service those products? I assume you still had some inventory.
Mr. Vandeputty?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were able to sell it to a prospective buyer that was approved. And to make a long story short, not take too much time, when we were not going to be renewed, I don't know the word to use. I was approached by somebody else that was interested in buying it. Where they found out I wasn't going to be renewed, well, anybody's guess. But somehow we were able to work out an agreement where the product was sold to a different dealer.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator Scheib.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I don't want to use up time, but otherwise would you have been able to get it back to the manufacturer and been compensated? That's
no.
I think the point I was trying to get.
I was told that when they didn't want to renew me, I said just okay, then just buy the product back. We don't do that. We do not do that, and it was led to me. It's up to me to do with it what I needed to, whether it be liquidated for 50 cents and a dollar, whatever. To answer your question, we are not able to warranty our previous customers. We're not able to order parts. We're not you know, we have 17 years of literally thousands of customers that we have to send somewhere else.
Thank you, and thank you for making the time to come down here. I really appreciate it, and I know that the committee appreciates.
Could I make one more comment before I leave? Because I cannot be back tomorrow. I would love to. This bill means everything to me, and it's not so much just me personally, but I have a son who wants to get in this business. I have some best friends and constituents that are in this business, and to answer Miss Olson's question. As far as there are reasons that the manufacturer can terminate us and not buy the product back. I believe there's eight of them, and Mr. Dady is much more of an expert on this than I am, but I think this bill was very well written in the fact that if there is just cause, they don't have to buy the product back.
That was my question. Madam Chair, Mr. Vandaputty. That was my question, because the way I'm reading this, they would have to buy it back. So maybe I'm misunderstanding what this is, but it seems to me like the way it's written now, it's going beyond the intent that you described. And so that might be something we'll have to look at tomorrow, ensure, because I don't think you are trying to suggest that you should have both those things. It should be one way or the other.
We'll take Senator Neville.
I'd like to ask Mr. Vandaputty a question as well. Are you just speculating that you weren't renewed because you had other lines or didn't sell a certain number, or did they actually tell you that explicitly?
Mr. Vandaputty?
Somewhat speculation. I don't believe that I have anything in writing that gives a specific reason. After the fact, there was some remedies in writing that, if we obtained 50% market share, some things like that. But verbally, I was led to believe that if I was willing to put up a different facility and have only one product line in it, I would be considered to be able to remain a dealer for that product. But only if I met, in my opinion, unobtainable or unreasonable objectives or goals.
And then, Madam Chair, let me ask Mr. Dady,
if
the dealers were to include in their normal franchise agreements that you have to sell so many or you have to have a certain market share or be only our dealer, nobody else's, and that was common in other contracts, that would still constitute due cause then if he didn't meet the quota?
There's kind of multiple parts to your, Madam Chair and Senator, kind of separate parts to your question, different answers. With respect to the first part, it's common in all of the industries I ticked off, automobiles, beer, cars, outdoor power equipment, to set performance criteria, including selling a certain number of units or a certain market share. And unless those criteria are unreasonable, that can constitute good cause for termination. With respect to exclusivity, different statutes prohibit manufacturers from coercing dealers to drop lines as a condition of being able to continue in the dealership. So the answers are slightly different. But if it's from the origination, if there's an agreement up front with respect to the shape of the dealership and the lines to be taken and not, including a commitment not to handle competing lines, that typically would be enforceable.
And Madam Chair, one more question for Mr. Dady. Is this something, this area, that's totally a state statute matter? There aren't any federal laws that touch on this?
Madam Chair and Senator, it is typically only a state issue. The one exception that I'm aware of, and I don't believe there are any others, is automobiles. So there's an Automobile Dealers Day in Court Act. In addition, there are state statutes around that typically have more teeth in them to protect automobile dealers. But in terms of this industry in particular and essentially every other industry, it's a state issue rather than a federal issue.
Okay. Thanks.
Good questions. Thank you.
Is there anybody who represent the manufacturers who feel like they need to get heard tonight because they're not going to be here tomorrow? Thank you. Very good. Thank you both so much,
Madam
Chair. Senator Foley?
One of the concerns I have in hearing somebody going before Commerce and other committees is how much of this is in our region and and what is in commerce and what's been done and what remains to be done.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, and that's a really good question, too, because I think the Commerce Committee generally felt somewhat overwhelmed in terms of dealing with franchise law. So, and so much of this has to do with contractual law and then remedies, that it's kind of woven all the way through the bill to be in front of this committee. I mean, we were dealing with the commerce issue, the manufacturer and the dealer and that balance and trying to strike a balance. But frankly, the bill is very...
Senator Foley, the subject is a commerce subject, but the contract and the tool that, you know, we're talking about is squarely within the jurisdiction of this committee. And it is also weighing and determining franchisor-franchisee relationships and, you know, how do you measure that and weigh that and the associated penalties and liabilities that come with that. And so I think to some extent we can try to parse out what's a commerce issue and what's a judiciary issue. But this is one of those bills where I think the whole bill is basically in this committee because of the nature of the agreement.
I don't object to that, yeah. Madam Chair. I just wanted some clarification as to where we're going. And I take it that we're going to finish this up tomorrow sometime.
And why is this a tax issue, or how does this get to the tax committee even, Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, members, the reason there's a tax provision in here is there are two types of vehicles which when you register, you have to register all of these vehicles. But there's two types of vehicles that, if you register, are currently not. For the deputy registers don't ask where it or what their state of origin is, so that there are many of these vehicles that are bought outside of the state, and there's no sales tax paid on them. Of course, there's a use tax requirement, but the second part of the bill requires that the deputy register ask that when all these vehicles are registered, they ask the state of origin and show purchase, the purchase documents, and therefore, if it's from another state and they haven't paid sales tax, they will have to then pay the sales tax. And that was certainly Senator Bach's interest.
Interesting. Thank you.
We
will pick up the this bill in the afternoon session, Mr. Anderson, and those who are interested. We have a limited time in the morning, and I think what we have slotted is going to take the full time. So, my office could probably give you a better idea, but given the load on the agenda, we'll try to fit you in as soon as we can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Committee is adjourned. Thank you, members.